There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free. And things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Good evening and welcome to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show. Good evening, Timothy.
Good evening.
Across the board from me, as always, Mr. Tim Dennis, my producer and co-host. Tim.
Yes.
We've got some exciting news coming up.
We do?
We do.
Ooh, sweet.
You ready to make the big announcement?
No.
Me neither. No, we'll be talking about it probably next week. So everybody keep your eyes peeled. Check out our MySpace page.
Can I just say this much?
What?
It's been a really fun run with you, buddy.
Yes, it has.
It has.
So keep checking our website at myspace.com, and mine is what, myspace.com/thedarknight, T-H-E-D-A-R-K-N-I-G-H-T. You can also check out our website at darknessradio.com for the forthcoming announcement.
And I'll repost it as well on mine.
Right. So. Yeah, we just want to thank everybody for all the support and love and friendship that they've shown us for the last 3 years of the show. And just stick with us this week and find out some more exciting stuff. Here's some other quick mentionables. Mentionables, Tim. Well, we just got back from Waverly Hills.
Mm-hmm.
Had a good ghost hunt out there. Another successful, fun event with a bunch of good people. We had great... What all happened? We had shadow people. I actually had my first full-on shadow person contact. I'm walking down the hall with Tina, you know, and she's the owner. Mm-hmm. Very nice lady, and I'm just politely listening to her. She says, turn off your lights. We're going to see shadow people. Oh, okay, Tina. So we turn off our lights. We start walking down the hall with no lights on, but you could just see the light at the end of the hall.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Tina's considerably shorter than I am. Mm-hmm. She's off to my right, and she said, look over here. So I'm looking off her way and looking, and sure enough, I see what looks to be something lean out of a doorway and duck back in. And I think, oh, that's kind of cool. And as I turn and look in front of me again, walking right up to me is a full-on, my height shadow person that walks right past me. So that was crazy. We got some great EVP work. We got some, a lot of people were getting touched and felt. And Tim, I've told you got to stop that.
I know. I'm sorry.
It's naughtiness.
I know.
But we had a great time out there. Some other fun stuff. And we're going to be talking about this, you guys, probably next week on the show. I want to discuss this a little bit. We are going to be talking about orbs, Tim.
I think
I may be changing my perspective on some of the orb theory.
Really?
Yeah, I was out on the 4th of July, and I haven't mentioned this yet because we've been busy.
Those are fireworks.
Oh, are they?
Yeah.
Damn it. No, we were out at 4th of July out at James Gilliland's Ranch again, and it did not disappoint. And I know I haven't talked about it on the last couple of shows, but that's because I wanted to keep things under wrap until we're a little closer.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got some really cool stuff I want to talk about with orbs, and I'll be posting a couple of pictures to show people as well. I do want to make a mention, too, that coming up in September, you'll be able to see me out at the UNIFCON,
mm-hmm.
and you can get more information by going to unifcon.org, I believe it is.
Yep.
And there's all the information there. There's going to be a lot of great speakers, including Freddy Krueger himself, Tim, is going to be out there.
Robert Englund.
Mm-hmm. He'll be joining us. He also might be joining us here on the show in the next week or two.
Hey, there you go.
So keep your eyes peeled and see what's going on guest-wise, but that's going to be a neat deal. They've got a lot of good speakers that are going to be out at unifcon.org, so I recommend that you check that out as well. And then before I get too far ahead of myself, I guess I should mention that I'm going to be in Alabama, Timothy.
I'm sorry.
No, don't be. I'm going to be out there on August 16th doing an event at the Mentone Inn in, I guess it's Mentone, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And Deb Collard from Knapps is hosting this along with the Mentone Inn. And I'm going to be out there doing a little talk on paranormal events that we do and talking about ghosts and doing my little common sense approach to ghost hunting and evidence review talk. You can get all the information and special room rates by going to their website. And you can do that by or just giving a call to 800-455-4000. 800-455-7470. Again, that's 800-455-7470. They have great rates on their rooms that you can get for the entire weekend and spend some time out there and do a little ghost hunting yourself. But if you just want to come on out there and hang out and see me, the whole event is really cheap. I think it's like $20 just to come out and hang out.
Wow.
Yeah, there's a $20 fee per person for the entire afternoon into the evening. Fun will start at 2 p.m. and last till 8 p.m. Then there's a break from 5 to 6 for folks to go to dinner. The Mentone Inn will also have overnight packages available. Hmm. So there's some cool stuff you can do there. And then, of course, our good friend Keith Age from Spooked fame is doing the Mid-South Paranormal Con, which will be the 7th annual con. It takes place September 26th through the 28th. 2008. I'll be out there with a lot of great speakers again, and we had a lot of fun out at that one last year, so I'd recommend check it out. You can get more information if you go to LouisvilleGHS.com. Again, that's LouisvilleGHS.com, and just click on their annual convention. We'll give it more information there, which leads us into tonight's guest, Timothy, because our guest this evening is actually going to be speaking there. It's Archbishop James Long. He's a licensed exorcist, demonologist. He's located out in Louisville, where we just came back from. And for people that are interested, they can check out his website while we're talking to him on the air. It's paranormalclergy.com. Again, that's paranormalclergy.com. Or you can go to universalcatholic.com. Again, universalcatholic.com. And let's welcome into the darkness on the edge of town, Archbishop James Long. Good evening, sir.
Good evening. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great, and I appreciate you spending some time with us here on Sunday night and talking to us. You know, before we get started, I want to ask you real quickly, how does one become a licensed exorcist or demonologist in this field?
Well, it's interesting because I'm not sure for sure on the licensing part. So I've never heard that that introduction, but I'm a demonologist and exorcist. By right of ordination.
Oh, okay. Actually, I think it was one of the people that had referred you onto the show. It sent a little deal and referred you as a licensed exorcist and demonologist. So that's why I wanted to check. I'd never heard anybody being licensed to do that. You know, kind of an interesting thing. Now, how long have you been dealing in this realm of the religion?
Well, as far as demonology, I've studied demonology since I was a 12-year-old kid. I mean, I have known since I was 5 that I wanted to be a priest. And so I've always had a calling for the priesthood, so that I knew. Again, even when I was in kindergarten, I knew that I wanted to be a priest. And so as the years went by, I also thought it wasn't good enough just to know that I wanted to be a priest. It's also important for me to know the other side as well. And so I began to studying demonology at a very early age. That's just a desire that I had, and I did. And so I know a lot of Father Malachi books and any type of writing that I could find on the particular topic I studied. Of course, it really became very aggressive as far as the studying as I went into the seminary. But
well, now, boy, you really did hear the calling. They say that, and I thought maybe that was just kind of a colloquialism. But, I mean, if you were at the age of 5 or 6 in kindergarten knowing you wanted to be a priest, what clicked with you on that to let you know? Was there any kind of quote-unquote religious experience you held that opened you up to this, that made you feel like this is your calling at that early in an age?
You know, at that age, I just I knew that's what I wanted to do. We were at kindergarten. Our teachers were asking all the kids what we wanted to, you know, be when we grew up. And a lot of people said police and doctor and lawyer. And there, without hesitation, I knew that I wanted to be a priest. And I said, well, I want to be a priest. And all the kids laughed. And but nonetheless, that desire has always grown. When my mom and I were at church, my parents actually, we were at church on Sunday, and she asked what we did on Friday, and I told her, and she said, well, what did you tell the teacher? I pointed at the priest, and I said, I want to do what he does. And so from a very early age, I just knew that was what God was calling me to do.
Well, now, growing up, did you, since you knew that this was part of your calling and what you wanted to have, did you feel a spirituality around you growing up doing this that you felt, you know, or were you able to sense it? I know we've talked to some priests and people involved in religion that are able to sense some of the otherworldly presences around us at times. Did you have that sense, especially at a young age when we seem, you know, kids are more open to this? Do you remember having any sense of paranormal activity at that age?
Yes. And after, there was one particular dream that I had. And I have it even quite often, even today, even currently. And it was at, again, I think it was around 9 years old or so. I had a pretty terrifying dream, and the event was pretty, it was terrifying, but it was inspiring as well, and I think that's what made me click, you know what, you need to learn about demonology. And so I did, and after I had this terrible dream, I decided, well, I'll go forward and learn what the opposite of good was.
Well, I know a lot of the people we speak to as well that are in this field, especially in the demonology end of it, they start getting messed with early on in this decision process. Did you start having, I guess, dark forces start mucking with you in your life and in your, personal world to try to dissuade you from doing what you wanted to do?
Oh, sure. I mean, all throughout life, I've always been distracted and or tried to be pushed off the path of being ordained. And again, I don't have a problem telling you about the particular dream that I had, or and still have. But it was really after that moment, after the when I was again around 9, I believe. That dream was so profound that for me, that was enough for me to say, okay, you know, it's good that you want to be a priest. It's good that you have a calling to be a priest, but there's also something else besides just the priesthood. So I felt that even at a very early age, I was called to study demonology. So I think it goes hand in hand.
Well, that's definitely interesting. Now, this is, there's so many people now that are entering this field and want to claim themselves as demonologists because they've read a bunch of books on, the Satanic Bible and books of demons. And, they've read some of the books by Father Malachi and such. I mean, first of all, for people that want to get in this field, what are your suggestions and recommendations? And what are the things to watch out for?
Boy, that's a heavy question. You know, I am really deeply concerned with the people who are claiming to be
good
demonologist, and more so, exorcist, and who have no formal training. Now, I studied for the Roman Catholic priesthood for 6 years. It was during the time that I was trained, I was mentored, and I will not give the person's name. The reason is I don't give the person's name, I receive hate mail on a daily basis. people don't like me for a variety of reasons because of what I do, and
right.
That I'm old Catholic, not Roman Catholic, and I just refuse to have my mentor go through what I have been going through and still going through. But I was mentored, and properly trained, and I am very, very concerned with those people who claim to be exorcists, who have no training whatsoever, and sometimes I'll listen to them on the radio, and I just shake my head, and I think that's why I've come out public. Recently, I had someone email me the other day and tell me that he was ordained, consecrated a bishop, and that he was an exorcist, and that he wanted to be a part of the institute that I created. And so I asked some simple questions, all right? Who ordained you, priesthood? Who consecrated you to the episcopacy? Where did you study? And as far as the tradition, the formal academic formation, where did you get it? Who mentored you? And finally, he confided in me. He said, I was ordained through the Internet. I paid $65 to get a certificate that says now I'm an exorcist, and I've never been to the seminary. So I told him, I want you to go to Scripture. And I want you to look at Acts 19, verse 11 through 20. And I want you to pay very, very, very close attention to those words. Because what happened is Paul was performing exorcisms and cleansing people, et cetera, in the name of Christ. And then a few fake exorcists came along, and in the name of Christ was provoking the name of Christ, was saying, and the person who was possessed says, you know, I know Paul, I know Jesus, but I don't know who you are. And they attacked these people. So, this was such an overwhelming response after people have heard about this. The group, the whole town came with all their magic, with all their magic books, and they burnt them. They just completely destroyed them, which totaled up to be roughly about 50,000 silver pieces, as far as totaled. The amount of money that was actually burnt up in smoke because people were so involved in this kind of stuff. So not a lot has changed. Even since the time of Paul,
right.
That people claiming to be exorcists and demonologists and who have no real training.
Well, doesn't it say, though, in the Bible that we have the authority to cast out demons in the name of Jesus Christ? Or is that being kind of twisted to...
Yeah, we have to look very pretty carefully on the Scripture, because when Christ went to the apostles and said, you have the power now to go and cast out demons and heal, et cetera, et cetera. Well, people forget the passages before that. Because the passage before that is that he bestowed the Holy Spirit upon them through ordination. And through ordination, then they were given by the right of ordained clergy to go out and perform these exorcisms. So we have to understand that it's parallel. It goes both. You can't take one passage out. You have to. They're both side by side.
Right.
So people say, well, I'm just going to go ahead and expel this demon into the name of Jesus Christ. Well, that's fine. You can do that, but you're not ordained clergy. And so through the rite of ordination, then we bestow those faculties upon the person to then cast out demons in the name of Christ. But it's those faculties have to be intact.
So the people that are out there now self-proclaiming themselves demonologists, are they opening themselves up to major bad juju, I mean, by going out into these kind of places, or are they just possibly going to do more harm to the people that they're trying to help?
Or I think,
a mixture of both?
Yeah, it really is. Here's the concern that I have between the term exorcist and demonologist. A demonologist is not necessarily an exorcist, and people have seemed to get those confused. A demonologist is one who studies demons, who have a lot of history and knowledge and is trained properly. Through the demonic activity, you know, what is demonic and what is not, and if they're trained properly, then okay, we're moving into the realm of demonology. But that doesn't mean, because we have laity demonologists, but they cannot perform exorcisms. So my deep concern is the people who are blatantly committing fraud. For example, you cannot be a satanic priest 1 month, and then the next month say, well, now I'm going to be an old Catholic priest and an exorcist. It doesn't work that way. And
now, can you explain to us, too, for those of us, you know, that don't understand this, what exactly is the difference between a demonologist and an exorcist? Where is that line drawn?
An exorcist is one who is ordained, who can perform the ritual of exorcism, which is a solemn ritual approved by their bishop, who then can perform the exorcism on the demonic entity. A person who is a demonologist is a person who studies demons. So, for example, I will use demonologists to determine whether or not if let's say, a group, a family says that they believe that they have a demonic infestation, then I will use a demonologist and I will say, I need you to go and investigate the situation. Tell me basically what is occurring, and then I want your opinion on if this is demonic or human. They will then submit the report to me, and then if I choose, based on the information, that an exorcism is needed, a solemn blessing, a solemn ritual, then I will then assign an exorcist to that particular home. Now, there is the minor rite of exorcism that the laity can perform, but I would never have someone ever perform that ritual if it's a true demonic infestation. I would not ever allow a demonologist to ever perform that if there's a true demonic infestation.
All right, now help us understand that part as well. Now you're saying if it's a true, so what, you send them out if it's like demon light that they're dealing with, as
well,
opposed to, you know, Satan or Beelzebub or whatever big names you want to throw out there?
I would be careful about mentioning the names.
Okay.
And the reason is your name is what?
David.
Okay. So if someone calls your name David.
Right.
Okay, that's going to get your attention.
Mm-hmm.
By calling out the name of demonic entities, you will be getting their attention as well.
Okay.
So you want to really avoid giving them any type of power or awareness that you're there. Now, when an exorcist performs an exorcism, he will want to know the name of the entity because, obviously, that's a form of control.
Right.
When you have the name of the entity that's present, then you can you obviously know what type of entity you're dealing with, first of all, but also you can control that entity by its name. But, for example, if you have a human haunting, let's say it's an interactive human haunt, and it's just an evil spirit, an evil human, who doesn't want to leave, who's harassing the people, then you can perform a blessing on the home, the minor rite, which would take care of that evil spirit. Because even sometimes when you perform blessings, evil human spirits will not leave.
Hmm.
And so if you perform the minor rite, which is obviously a step above, then you perform that ritual. It's a complete cleansing of the home. With a minor rite of exorcism, that's a bit different. Because that person is then, you're holding that person accountable for their intentions. And if their intentions remain evil, it is believed theologically, they will obviously go to the opposite of heaven, which is hell.
Okay. Let's take our quick first break here. Stick with us if you don't mind. We're going to be right back. You're listening to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show.
Once you have seen Dave and Tim in the light, you'll understand why we must return to the Darkness on the Edge of Town. Stay tuned. There is more to come.
In the Amityville Horror, the ghost told them to get out the house. White people stayed in there. Now that's a hint and a half for your ass. A ghost say get the out, I would just tip the out the door. They walked and looked in the toilet bowl with blood in the toilet.
I said, that's peculiar.
I would have been in the house and said, oh baby, this is beautiful. We got a chandelier hanging up here, kids outside playing, it's a beautiful neighborhood. We ain't got nothing to wear. I really love them, this is really nice. Too bad we can't stay, baby.
We're the type of guys who would have stayed just for the extra company. Welcome back to the Darkness on the Edge of Town.
Good evening and welcome back to the show. You're listening to the Darkness on the Edge of Town with our guest, Bishop Long. Now, let me get this straight just so I've got the correct terminology as well. Are you Archbishop or Bishop Long?
I'm the presiding Archbishop for the United States Old Catholic Church.
Now, can you help us as well? I grew up, as my dad said, Lutheran, and I don't know, I don't understand the whole hierarchy of the Catholic Church. So where does an archbishop come in? Are you just below the Pope but above an altar boy? I mean, how does that exactly work?
Well, I guess this is definitely the time to explain. I am not Roman Catholic. I study for the Roman Catholic priesthood. I am Old Catholic, and so the Old Catholic branch from the Roman Catholic Church in 1890s or so, 1894, I believe, when the Pope declared himself infallible on church doctrine without error. And so many people within the church just didn't believe that. They didn't want to go back to papal power, political power, and that's what they believed. And they said, no, you're human. You cannot be without error. Only Christ is without error. And so there was a split within the church. And I, through my spiritual formation, through the Roman seminary, I decided that God was calling me to serve in the Old Catholic Church. And I can understand why now, because with being an Old Catholic bishop and now doing what I do, I'm able to reach out to people that I would not be able to reach out if I were ordained a Roman Catholic priest. So, for example, people can come to me and they can be Baptists, they can be Lutherans, as you say.
All right.
Or they can be Christian, non-denominational, and I can still reach out to them and perform the rituals if that was necessary. Whereas Roman Catholics is a little different.
Now, can you be called in if say, somebody of the Jewish faith seems to be possessed or somebody of Muslim faith? Would they call in somebody like you to do this, or do they call in, I mean, are there different versions of you in every religion? Are there, you know, exorcists and demonologists in the Jewish faith and Episcopal faith and the Muslim faith and the, you know, so on and so forth?
And there really are. Most of the mainline religions will have some type of either spiritual helpers, healers, exorcists, whatever you want to call it. In Islam, I believe that the evil spirit is jinn, or known as the devil. And there are those people within the Islamic faith as well as the other faiths as well that will help. Now, there are even some mainstream religions that don't believe that you are necessarily possessed, whereas actually it's more of an attachment, or you have to go through some type of cleansing of your soul to get rid of those attachments. And so it really just depends on the actual faith that you're speaking of.
Well, let me ask you this. Break that down for us a little bit, too, then. What are the different levels? I mean, what's the difference between an attachment and a possession or an oppression?
Oh, sure. Well, now, when you're talking about a demonic oppression, are you talking about demonic infestation? Because when you have infestation, oppression, possession. Oppression is when it attacks you and you get to a point where it changes your whole entire personality. You become isolated. You act out in anger. It changes your whole personality. You begin to feel oppressed. You begin to feel...
Well, let me stop you right there then. How do we know the difference between depression, you know, standard chemical, out-of-whack depression and dealing with life's BS, and oppression and having something attached to you that's draining you and bringing you down?
And many times they're very similar. That's why a trained exorcist will never tell you that when they go into the home, they immediately perform the ritual. If you ever interview anybody, uh-huh. and they ever tell you, oh, yes, I'm a trained exorcist, and ask the question, well, when you go in, do you just you start the ritual? Absolutely. They're not properly trained.
Okay.
Because, number one, if the person, let's say the person is suffering from MPD, multiple personality disorder, and you do an exorcism on this, you perform an exorcism, you can then create another personality, which is terrible. And the person may not be possessed at all. Now, a truly trained exorcist who knows what they're doing will do things prior to the ritual even beginning. Now, of course, okay. they've already done the investigations. They've already had their demonologists involved. So they have all this information already. But even then, when I go into a home, I'm doing things that the person has no clue what I'm doing. They have no idea. And I will never divulge that information, but the demonic entity will. And most of the time, the people that are claimed to be who are possessed are not in the possessed state. You have transient possession. So I will walk in, and I will do things purposely to provoke this entity to manifest itself, possess the person, perform the ritual.
So you're kind of like an annoying in-law who shows up just to get under the skin of the husband, right?
Pretty much.
And then you do the little things that you know will tweak the bad guys, and then they start to rise up, and that gives you the sign if they're there or not.
Absolutely.
And if you don't get that rise from them, then you know that you're dealing probably more with a psychological issue?
Absolutely. If you don't get the rise at all, then you are dealing with a psychological issue, or you could be dealing with a poltergeist, or you could be dealing with a human haunting. So you will get the demonic entity will manifest itself if you do the steps procedurally, if you do them accurately and appropriately.
Is there something palpable that you can judge? I mean, are there times when you can walk into a home and you haven't even talked to the person, the husband opened the door, the wife is the one supposedly possessed, you walk in the home and there's just, you know it, you know that you're about to face something nasty, as opposed to, you know, I mean, I don't know, are there triggers for people that are exorcists to know this? Or do you have a sense, are you in a way a bit psychic or mediumistic that you can sense the evil in the home? Or is it just, like you said, you just got to kind of, you know, twist a couple nuts and bolts and see if something pops?
Yeah, I think if you perform a real exorcism, and I say, and I keep saying the word real, and there's a reason
right.
for that, because the possession is rare. Mm-hmm. And people who say, oh, I've performed over 200 exorcisms. No, you haven't. I don't think you have. Because the leading exorcist in Rome hasn't performed over 200 exorcisms.
Really? Okay.
So that's a huge red flag for me. So what I do, for me, I'm not a psychic, but if you perform a real exorcism, and I've performed 23, and it changes you. I mean, you no longer are that same person you were before you walked in. It completely changes your entire perception on everything. And so, yes, you will see things and hear things that you normally never heard before. But I don't necessarily go back on that necessarily as I do on... I had a very close relationship with my aunt. I loved her dearly. She was a wonderful soul. And she loved roses. Roses were her favorite. She just loved roses. She always had that scent of roses. And when I go into a home that is truly diabolically or demonic possessed or infested, I will get an overwhelming sensation of a rose smell. I mean, just overwhelming, to where people even around me can smell it. And I will know that I'm about to enter into a hostile environment, and I also know that my aunt's there with me. And so for me, after I've done the fasting, after I've done the things that I've had to do, confession, et cetera, before I even walk into a home, I feel comforted. And so that's my sign of knowing that, okay, we're moving into a situation where it could be dangerous.
Why do you believe that your aunt wouldn't be over on the other side just doing what she needs to do? Why would she come back to help you face evil? Do you believe that there's a chance that maybe it's not necessarily your aunt, but an angelic that takes on something to remind you, to give you the sense of strength, or make you feel like you have somebody covering your back, and that's the tangible proof that they'll give to you that you're loved?
Well, I think that it could be, in fact, an angelic in nature, but I think it's more I sense her. I just know that she's present. It's one of those very comforting feelings of when I recall the days that I spent with her and talked with her and chat and, you know, just spent time with her. It just, I feel that it is her that's present. When we pass on, those relationships that we develop here on earth, they remain on in heaven. Those relationships don't end. And so those attachments that we also have don't end as well. Now, I think that their human spirits remain on Earth because they haven't let go necessarily of those attachments, and so they remain here on Earth. So they don't go through that transition of letting go. So in other words, for example, I've performed last rites on people. I've given the last rites, and you see an overwhelming just calmness that comes over their body. They let go of all the stress, all the anxieties, and they're ready to move on.
Right.
But those relationships still remain, the relationships that you've made here on Earth. And so when someone obviously doesn't go through that transition of letting go, they remain on Earth because they're still earthly bound or earthly attached to whatever object or person or whatever it is that they're attached to. And so for me, when I walk into a situation, and I have all the evidence already before I even walk in, it's just overwhelming calmness that just comes about me. Now, and I just know that obviously it's demonic.
Now, can you tell us, for the people that are tuning in, I mean, how much has Hollywood influenced the hype of what an exorcism is as opposed to what a real exorcism is like? You know, we've heard from some clergy who said that, you know, the Exorcist was a very close depiction, you know, a little Hollywoodized, but it was a very close depiction to what a real exorcism can be. We've heard from others that it was a, you know, way over dramatized and the special effects and the insanity of it all.
Sure, yeah. And of course, it depends also on the type of possession you're dealing with, whether it's diabolical or demonic. The Exorcist in itself...
Well, what's the difference between a diabolical and a demonic?
When you're dealing with a diabolical, you're dealing with multiple legions. You're dealing with multiple demons, possibly Satan himself. And there was a 17-year-old girl in which I was the assistant to the exorcist of my mentor, as a matter of fact, and we performed an exorcism, and she was diabolically possessed. The difference between the two, both are very aggressive. Both can kill the person. But a diabolical possession would becomes physically violent to the point where it will destroy the body. So, like, for example, you have someone who is demonic possessed. There's a lot of screaming, wailing. There's a lot of you do see objects being flown around, speaking in different languages. Those things occur on demonic possession. Diabolical is when the person actually begins to bite off their tongue or gouge their eyes out, or scratch themselves so much to where they're have serious lacerations on their face or body. The violence, the oppression becomes tenfold. So
why would they try to hurt the host body if that's where they're living, essentially? Wouldn't it be kind of silly for them to destroy the thing that's keeping them here and giving them that ability?
But see, Dave, you answered your question. The purpose of a demonic entity, a diabolical entity, is to destroy the person. So the ultimate goal is for the person. Ultimate goal is for the person to commit suicide, and so to attack the body to the point where it's killing the body. For example, if you have a person who is possessed, and even if you give them water, just basic water, that's an element in which it's to sustain life. The person will become violently ill, and so you have to be very careful about even the substance that you give the person. Because that could kill the person, because the person could constantly regurgitate to the point where dehydration sets in. The Exorcist in of itself was an interesting movie, and there were some elements to it that are real. But the Exorcist exorcism of, as we know, Emily Rose or Annalise Michel, that is really pretty much what a diabolical exorcism looks like.
All right, so that can go on. Now, the whole idea... Why is it that they want to drive him to suicide? Because then they've given up the soul, and then they can claim the soul?
No. The possession, demonic entities never possess the soul. They possess the body. The reason is it drives a person to the brink of the total depression, to where suicide sets in. Because when you think of suicide, you think of total depressed state of mind in which no hope exists. That is the lowest that a person can possibly get. When they commit suicide, they feel that there's no other hope. That entity has literally taken everything away from this person. Now, I truly believe firmly, and you're going to have listeners in your audience who listen to this show, and I don't care if people disagree with me or not, I believe with all of my heart, all of my soul, all of my mind, that those people who commit suicide are absolutely sitting at Jesus' feet in heaven. Because when you commit suicide, you're not in the right state of mind, and so therefore, how can you be held accountable for those actions? So therefore, you're held accountable for the actions that you know that you're doing wrong, and you're still committing those acts. But if a person is in a true state of depression, to where they commit suicide, they're not in the right state of mind. So I don't think an all-loving, all-caring, all-nurturing God would say, okay, I'm condemning you to hell. That's absurd.
And you know what? That's interesting that you'd bring that up. That's always been something that I was curious about, and I felt the exact same way, that I would find out that if it's a chemical imbalance or something that was that out of whack, that God would be forgiving and understanding and probably, if anything, more loving to that person that felt so abandoned in life that they would be welcomed into heaven.
Absolutely, because that's where the evil lies in the intentions. And so now that you can perform an evil act.
Right. Now, if I convince Tim to kill himself and then I kill myself, that may not be as, you know.
Well, I don't know. It depends on if you have what's called an erroneous conscience. So, like, for example, if you have an erroneous conscience, you believe that doing evil is actually good. That is a chemical imbalance. The act itself is evil. So, yes, you performed an evil act, but at the same time, you have an erroneous conscience. And if you have an erroneous conscience, can you really be held accountable for those actions? A person who is in the right state of mind, who commits the crime and knows that it is evil and knows the opposite of that evil and still performs that evil, then they're held culpable. But if the person has erroneous conscience and they believe that an evil act is good and they perform that evil act, I don't think an all-loving, all-caring God would condemn that person to hell. I think there's a form of cleansing after we pass on before we go to heaven. But I don't necessarily think that person's going to lose eternity.
Let me ask you this then, all right? If that's so much the case, if we're all children of God and we're all born here, what about the third world countries where Christianity is not taught? They don't know that there's a God and a Jesus. They're praying to the Easter Bunny and Ronald McDonald because that's who they told we're told are the gods,
sure.
And they live their life decently and they're respectful to Ronald and give their life that way to the Easter Bunny. And then when they die, where is their place?
Most certainly in heaven, and I'll tell you why. Because when a person grows up in a culture in which God is not introduced, instead of the Easter Bunny, that person cannot be held culpable of that act because of their society, culture, personality that was influenced on them. So in other words, the society, culture, personality, Dr. Marcel Fredericks, who was a phenomenal sociologist at the Loyola University where I went, he taught us the SCP module, which when you grow up, you are influenced by your society and culture. And so therefore, if this type of religion is taught to this person, and yet you said the magic words, they do good. They may not have the knowledge of God, but they have the knowledge of good. And if they're performing the good, they're performing the acts of God.
Well, here I'll throw a real ticking time bomb in your lap then. The September 11th attacks were coming up on the anniversary. These chuckleheads believe they were doing the work of their God. They believe that they were doing what was righteous and pure, and that they were going to be well rewarded for this. You know, that was a religion and the belief that they were brought up in, and they held to it strictly and strongly. As a matter of fact, they're over-the-wall religious zealots about what they did, and in belief that they were serving their God. Where does that put them?
Erroneous conscience. Now, at the same time, I pray that God has mercy on their soul.
Right.
But
then there's part of you that hopes that he's letting them get their ass kicked in hell a little bit, right?
No. I don't hope. I hope no one is in hell.
Right.
I people think that I'm theologically speaking. I don't because when you start hoping for that evil upon others,
right,
that evil can become upon you, and so I don't wish anyone to go to hell. I'm hoping that through the grace and the blessing and the cleansing after you pass away, you see the truth and you get your cleansed through that. But they clearly had an erroneous conscience. They clearly thought that what they were doing were good. Some of them, actually, there were a couple that actually were going to leave because they kept thinking this is wrong. Now, in that case, those people have a different situation because they knew the right, they committed the wrong.
Gotcha.
That's a different story.
A quick follow-up to that. Now, when you're talking about faiths in general, it's not in the basic Muslim belief to take someone's life the way the September 11th attackers took those people's lives.
That's exactly right.
So wouldn't you say that that radical faction of the Muslim religion is more of a choice than an erroneous conscience?
I don't know. Just because you have, well, let's look at the Christian faith. Let's look at those people who blow up abortion clinics, and they're doing it all in the name of God. Now, the Christianity does not teach this, and neither does the Muslim faith. The Quran does not teach to blow up buildings and to kill people. And so, therefore, I believe that if someone is mentally ill to the point of, again, society, culture, personality, let's look at this for a second. There are children in some of these Muslim countries that are being brought up and taught that it is okay to be a terrorist, that it is okay to die for your country, for your faith. They're being indoctrinated into this type of religion. I shouldn't say religion, this occultist activity. They're being indoctrinated into this. And so that develops that person's psyche, the person's society, culture. It develops the person and their thoughts and everything. So when they go out and they perform these acts, because they were always taught this and they believe that it was actually truly good, then that person really has had a major injustice done to them. It's terrible what they do. The act itself is terrible. Absolutely terrible.
But the intent behind it is what is judged? Is that what you believe? That if they believe that they were doing good and they were doing it in the name of the best, that then their judgment, you know, like you said, there may be a sense of cleansing they have to go through, but their judgment will not be as harsh?
Well, again, you're dealing with an erroneous conscience, so the intention is different. So my intention, right, for example, would be to kill somebody. All right, so the intention is evil, but you have to take in consideration of the erroneous conscience. The person has no conscience. The person's consciousness is distorted. Okay. They don't know the difference between right and wrong, and they really truly believe that going out and killing this person all for the sake of Allah is actually what they need to do. So therefore, you're dealing with someone's psyche, someone's psychological issues, obviously. And so it's a different story. In order for an act to be evil or sinful, you have to know that it is sinful. You have to know the opposite of that act, which is good, and yet still perform that evil act. For example, I go out, I rob a bank. I know that robbing a bank is evil. I know that I should not rob a bank, but yet I still do it anyway. Now, I performed an evil act. I know that it is sinful, therefore I did wrong.
All right. We're going to take our second break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Darkness on the Edge of Town.
The New York Times has raved about the show. The Star Tribune says it's paranormally funny. And the Biscayne Bugle said, how could they put this crap on the air and live with themselves?
I am so sorry for everything that has happened. Because in spite of what Mike says now, it is my fault. Because it was my project. Everything had to be my way. And this is where we've ended up.
Stay tuned. There's more to come from the darkness on the edge of town. When Dave was a young boy, he once awoke to find himself staring directly into the eyes of a shadow person. Turns out it was just his life-size cardboard cutout of Donny Osmond.
Go away.
Welcome back to The Darkness on the Edge of Town.
See, it was just a life-size cardboard cutout of Donny Osmond you saw at Waverly.
It was not. It was moving towards me.
Well, then it was Donny Osmond himself.
If only, Tim. Don't taunt me with that.
Sorry.
We're going to go back into the show. We're talking about demonology and exorcism. And Tim, before, as soon as we went to break, you said that you had kind of a follow-up question for the Archbishop. So why don't you go ahead and throw that to him? And
it's kind of a follow-up and kind of a continuation of what we were talking about before the break. You have people of different denominations, religions, if you will, that say, well, there are no such thing as demons. And they also swear that, you know, there's no such thing as evil influences, that everything out there is goodness and light. And I guess I would ask you, how do you convince these people otherwise?
You know, sometimes you just can't. Sometimes you just can't convince them. Let me tell you. Let me just say this. This ministry that I do is a ministry that I do for free. I never charge ever, and I won't ever charge. And I will tell you this: if I spent a lot of time on this particular ministry, a lot of my time, if I was not convinced that demonic entities do exist, that possession does occur, I think I'd probably find another hobby. Because the amount of time and money that I put into this is overwhelming. And for some people, you just can't convince them. You just can't. You can just tell your stories and what you've experienced and what you've seen, and then they either take you at your word, or they just simply brush it off and say, well, that's just nonsense.
Do you believe that these people who believe that there are no demons out there are actually more susceptible to some sort of possession themselves?
I don't know necessarily more susceptible. I just think they're living in a state of denial. There are many, and I always make people, some people angry when I say this, but there are many atheists in the world, but the last words of an atheist are, oh, God. So
amen.
You can deny. The fact is people can deny all they want to, but demonic entities are not contingent upon whether or not people believe in them or not, because they do. And so, honestly, it's one of those things. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink.
Right.
I can give them all the information, say, here it is, here's the proof, here's everything that everything we have. And they can either say, you know what, I this is amazing, or I still don't believe. For example, an incubus case. I work very closely with After Dark Paranormal Investigators here in Louisville, and we have been working on an incubus case, terrible, terrible case. And we have a real video of the incubus actually inside the bed with this woman. And you clearly see her bed sheets rise way up above her head and her body and slam down. I mean, and then she starts screaming because it begins to attack her.
Oh.
And this woman, I tell you, it's a terrible case, guys. It's one of those cases that it tears at your heart, because I have performed rituals there in her home. She's being attacked still, but it's not as aggressive. So it's kind of calmed down to a point where she's living with it, whereas before she was in intensive care. I mean, this was killing her.
Unbelievable.
A terrible, terrible act.
How do you, two-fold question. Unfortunately, our time is running out quick on this here, but what do you recommend to people? What do they avoid doing? What will open them up to possible oppression or possession? What can they do to not be susceptible to these type of things?
Sure. Well, first of all, don't provoke. Stop the provoking. For those people who are claiming to be demonologists and exorcists, if you are not properly trained, then you need to be fair and honest, because you're going to hurt people. Because let's forget the theological implications when you're doing an exorcism. Let's talk about the legal issues. There are a lot of legal issues that you have to know before you even step foot into that person's door. And if you don't know them, you need to back away. Just little things like clipping their nails, making sure you clip their nails all the way down to the point before you even walk into their home. Little things like that, so they won't gouge your eyes out.
Right.
If you don't know this stuff, then stop pretending. This is not playtime. It's not Hollywood. And so what you're going to do is, and people are going to get hurt, and that's a disservice to those people who are truly being affected. But I think people need to learn the outward manifestations of a demonic entity. What are the physical? What are the mental? How do you know if you're dealing with if you're really truly dealing with a diabolical or demonic versus a human spirit? And there are things to know. Very quickly, banging on the walls, usually in threes, the mocking of the Trinity, scratching. These are all demonic infestations. Loud scratching, foul odors. Animals will become very spooked, and they usually tend to run away. They become aggressive. There is desecration of religious objects. People begin to feel an overwhelming sensation of oppression when they go into a particular area. Those are all outward manifestations. Heavy furniture can move on its own. If you're in a home and you're doing an investigation and you have a heavy furniture that is moving, that is not a human spirit. Human spirits cannot manifest enough energy to move a heavy object. And if the demonic entities, when they move an object, they have a purpose. And the purpose is to scare you or hurt you. So you need to know, people need to know those type of stuff, as well as the physical changes and the mental changes, because there are some. And so if you, infestation, oppression, possession, those are the stages of possession. And if people do have an infestation case and they're out investigating and you have those signs, you need to step away and call the clergy.
Let me ask you this. Children's ghosts. We've got about 3 minutes left.
Mm-hmm.
Should we be leery of spirits that claim to be children?
Absolutely. I dealt with a case, as a matter of fact, where a mother lost her 5-year-old boy because he got hit by a car. She was obviously distressed about it, and 2 days later she was so happy she was singing the same lullaby she sang every single day. The family called me in. I went to her house. She was seeing a full body apparition of her son. The problem was it was not her son. It was a demonic entity. Demonic entities will try to manifest themselves to mimic either human voices or human bodies, the apparitions. But there's always a flaw. So with the human apparitions, you can't see the eyes. There's something not right about that apparition that's demonic. With a voice, it may sound like your loved one that's passed, but in fact, there's always a flaw, there's a cracking, there's something of that nature. So you know that that's not actually the human or your relative that's passed on. If you're playing with Ouija boards, stop it. There's no filter that can filter out the evil spirits from the human spirits. The problem was also pay very close attention to the spelling. Demonic spirits don't have the knowledge of spelling, and so chances are they'll spell incorrectly. But you shouldn't play with a Ouija board anyway, because, again, you can't filter out the evil from the good.
Right. What about EVP work? We only have about a minute left.
Stay away from EVPs. EVPs in themselves are okay. The problem with EVPs, if you play, rewind, then you're having an interaction with the spirit. That could be demonic. So if you just leave it played and just play it out loud and then play it back later, that's one thing. But if you play reverse, then you're actually having an open communication with the entity. And again, you don't know if it's human or inhuman.
Well, Bishop, we've had a great time having you on the show with us tonight. I know that sounds strange when we're talking about demonic and evil entities, but it's been very informative. And you know what? I'd love to have you back on here in the very near future to where we can explore this a little bit more deeply, take some more questions from our audience and flesh that out. Are you open to come back for us?
I would be honored. You guys have been very gracious.
Great. Well, thank you very much for spending some time with us this evening. And again, people can see you out at the Louisville Ghost Hunters Mid-South Paranormal Conference that's coming up in September, correct?
That is correct.
All right, great. Well, thank you very much, sir. Much continued success to you, sir. I hope that you keep fighting the good fight and stay on top of things.
Well, thanks so much, guys. It's been my pleasure, really, yes.
All right, and is there a phone number or an email address they can reach you if they're having problems?
502-773-1883. That's After Dark Paranormal Investigators, and they will contact me. Or paranormalclergy.com or usocc.org. That's the church's website.
Great. Well, thank you very much, sir. Thank you all for tuning in to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show. We're going to be back with more and our special guest from TV's Most Haunted, Kieran O'Keefe, right after this.